From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, both parties react to President Trump's State of the Union speech.
What I can work with this president on, he talked about children and cancer. Oh my goodness, we must and we should address that.
I actually jumped up and applauded the president when he spoke about the fact that we stand with immigrants, illegal immigrants, and we want more of them.
Plus, a defense against hackers.
Open source hardware can be more secure than closed hardware because the customers actually know what they're getting.
And West Michigan music.
Jordan Hamilton is based in Kalamazoo. He's a 26-year-old classically trained celloist. His music blends hip-hop, soul, and classical music in a really trailblazing way, in my view.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
President Trump gave his State of the Union address last night, the third longest in history, and for the first time, he faced a Democratic-controlled House.
In the past, most of the people in this room voted for a wall, but the proper wall never got built. I will get it built.
With us now, Democratic Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence of the 14th District from Metro Detroit. Congresswoman, the president said his goal was to deliver a message of bipartisanship and unity. Did you hear that?
At the beginning and at the end, and then there was the middle. He said the words. The challenge with him speaking is that he contradicts himself constantly and that his words don't match his action. I am always hopeful that there can be a transformation, but it was brief. It sounded very scripted. And then he went into things like, stop investigating me, and that talking about socialism, which we stood up and applaud because we do not, as Democrats, support a socialist government. But then you say you don't want socialism, but you're going to tell the government that they should not have checks and balances, that they should not hold accountability to any elected official, and that there should not be due process. And so it was a very confusing speech and very long.
What did you make of that moment when the president said there will be no legislation and no peace if there is an investigation into his administration or his plans to pull our troops out of Syria and Afghanistan? And there was basically I think he was waiting for an applause point from the GOP, and that did not come. What did you make of that moment?
Just that I don't know who his advisors are, and that he really missed the mark there, because the GOP, the majority of them, understands the necessity to investigate. And we have to investigate and continue to provide the services and take care of our citizens in the United States. He was ill-advised, and that was just a very, I feel, inappropriate statement.
Did you hear anything, Congressman, in his speech that you could say, you know what, we could work with this? Anything to give Democrats and Republicans a starting point to work on, particularly to immigration and his demand for a wall?
I wish so much that in the spirit of bipartisanship, that we can have a discussion about border security. And border security is comprehensive. And for him to get stuck on just give me the wall because he made a political promise that he's not upholding because he said Mexico is going to pay for it. But there are so many opportunities with innovation, with securing the walls that already exist, that we need to make sure that they are structurally sound. There is a need to increase hiring. What I can work with this president on, he talked about children and cancer. oh my goodness, we must and we should address that. However, his administration has defunded the health, the department that does the medical research, the department that would actually have to be engaged in doing the trial studies and all the things that we need to do in science and the healthcare industry so that we can fight these chronic diseases and have advancements. The other thing that was just so challenging for me is with all of the heartbreak that we went through with the shooting at the synagogue that just ripped us apart as a country. And he highlighted the suffering of the individuals by having them as his guests. And not once did he mention gun violence. Not once did he mention gun control. Not once did he mention that we have a problem in America with guns. And so it was a half step. Oh, and the other thing that was so disappointing, I was anxious to talk about transportation. And he had highlighted, you know, his pre-statements was that we're going to finally work together on infrastructure. I came into Congress wanting to work on infrastructure, and I like to use this statement now. We elected a governor who said she's going to fix the damn roads. I want to write the check in appropriations now to fix the roads. And it was just a one-liner, and it went on to something else. It was no substance, no real commitment, and no vision on how we're going to fix our infrastructure in America.
Democratic Representative Brenda Lawrence from the 14th District from Southfield, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
And now we turn to Rocky Raskowski, who's the chair of Oakland County's Republican Party. Rocky, the president said he wanted to deliver a message of unity and bipartisanship. Did you hear that?
I think I did, and I think majority of Americans did. CBS did an interesting poll right after the speech, the State of the Union address, and it showed that 76% of Americans actually appreciated the president's speech and thought he did a great job. And I think the tone, the tenor, everything across the board was very much in line with the majority of where the United States is, which tends to still be a center-right country.
What else did you hear in the speech? I'm wondering, there's some discussion as to whether he was going to be speaking to all Americans in 2019 or to his base looking ahead to 2020. What do you think?
Well, Cindy, let me just state right off the fact, I don't think he was speaking to his base, because if he was speaking to his base specifically, there'd be a lot more red meat. And when I say red meat, a lot more hot button issues thrown in there that would get much more conservative audience revved up and excited about what he had to say. I think what he was speaking was more of a populist center-right speech, which basically covered everything from bringing more jobs to the United States, improving our economy, all the way through to protecting our country, investing into where the NIH, the National Institute of Health, should invest on funding to fight terrible childhood diseases, childhood cancers, as well as adult diseases of AIDS, expanding the old PEPFAR program, which actually started under President Bush, 43. So there were a lot of, I don't think that he was speaking to his base, but what he was speaking to was the larger centrist portion of the United States, which swings into the conservative Democrats all the way through the Republican swath of people that identify themselves as independents, Republicans, and Democrats.
Rocky, what about that moment in his speech, his line, if there's going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation? What did you think about that statement of his that many viewed as kind of a threat to Congress?
I viewed it as a great rhyme. It was very poetic. If you think about it, it did rhyme, and people actually are bringing it up. I'm not sure I totally understood exactly where that was heading, but overall, if the president was specifically focusing on the fact that we should not be doing these partisan investigations, actually find an investigation, do the investigation, do the due diligence of the Department of Justice, and then let's move on. If there isn't anything, it shouldn't be a witch hunt. And if you recall, even under the Clinton administration, when President Clinton was investigated, there were a few things that the investigation of the Whitewater investigation went on beyond Whitewater and somehow ended up with Monica Lewinsky. So right or wrong, there are things that pop up, and investigations should focus specifically on what they're targeted to investigate, unless they find what's called fruit of the poisonous tree, unless they find specific facts that lead them to other wrongdoings.
Why do you think the president never said a word about the historically long partial government shutdown and the workers, the government workers who paid the price for that action?
I think he did, actually. He did talk about working together and finding greatness, and he did stress the wall. He put his line in the sand. And actually, if you look at how the president's been dealing, I know that the public gave the president bad marks at the beginning of the partial government shutdown. It wasn't a total government shutdown because the funding for the national defense and other portions of our government were already funded through this year. So there were specific sections of the government that were shut down on this partial government shutdown. And the president did address the fact where he stood and why this is an issue, why this is a national security issue. He also pointed out that, quite frankly, maybe not as good as he should have, but he pointed out that Speaker Pelosi and a majority of the Democrats that sat in that congressional chamber, in that House chamber, voted for a wall, voted for the wall protections, and then that money was not used for the development of the wall or the technology to stop the influx of illegal immigrants into the United States. Listen, I'm a son of immigrants. My wife and her family were immigrants when she was a very young girl at age 5. And I agree, and I actually jumped up and applauded the president when he spoke about the fact that we stand with immigrants, illegal immigrants, and we want more of them to make our country better. We're a great country of a melting pot. But when you break the law, when you illegally come here and you cost our country, then that's a totally different issue. And the president put that on the table and basically spoke about that and why it's important to have the wall.
Rocky Raskowski, chair of Oakland County's Republican Party, thanks so much.
Hey, it was a pleasure to talk to you, and look forward to doing it again.
Coming up, we'll hear some of the latest music coming out of West Michigan and the story of two brothers who broke ground to become pioneering African-American entrepreneurs in Saginaw.
They had access to the complete community. Everybody came to their studio to have a portrait or something done by the Goodrich brothers.
That story is in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time to check in on West Michigan's music scene as we say hello to John Sinkovich, music critic, editor, publisher of LocalSpins.com. So, John, who leads off our artists this time around?
This time we're going to start off with Mellophobics, and I don't know how else to say this, but these guys just have an absolute blast when they play live, and that's really infectious. And so really, they become one of West Michigan's must-see live acts, in my view, because they have this really groovy blend of funk and rock and reggae and ska and pop and R&B, which really makes them a lot of fun to dance to and to just hang out with. They released an EP a couple of years ago, and they finally released their first full-length album in January, and boy, is it a wild and winsome ride.
Well, this is what we're talking about. This is Get Over It from Cage Free, the new album by Mellophobics. Oh, fun. It sounds like a really interesting stew of a lot of different influences.
Yeah, and the sizzling horn arrangements, I think, are really important to this as well, especially when you're talking about ska and reggae and funk. It really makes it a lot of fun to listen to.
And it does sound like they really are. There's so much energy. It sounds like they would really be a lot of fun to see. So what about shows coming up?
So they recently played a big show with Sublime with Rome at 20 Monroe Live here in downtown Grand Rapids, and they also released a Christmas album, had a lot of fun with that in December, and now they're going to be playing O'Toole's in Grand Rapids on February 25, The Livery in Benton Harbor on March 23, and Elevation at the Intersection in Grand Rapids on April 11th.
So there's lots of opportunity then if you want to see this must-see live act, Mellophobics, from Grand Rapids. So who's up next?
So if you ask any West Michigan musician over the last several months or anybody who's seen Jordan Hamilton perform live, you will get unanimous raves for this innovative artist. Jordan Hamilton is based in Kalamazoo. He's a 26-year-old classically trained celloist. His music blends hip-hop, soul, and classical music in a really trailblazing way, in my view. He grew up in Maryland, moved to Ohio to go to school, and then relocated to Kalamazoo to get his master's degree at Western Michigan University. And he's influenced by everything from Bobby McFerrin and Bill Withers to, you know, cellists like Stephen Braun and Jacqueline Dupre and others. And he considers his alternative hip-hop music as, quote, soul music at the core. And really, that's what it is. But it is, I tell you, it is really engaging, and it really catches your ear and your eye when you see him.
Back to the land where I started from. No silly dreams for the silent one. Home is a place where I'm listening. In Kalamazoo, Michigan. Far from the mindset, home alone. You can swim a little bit small, grown. Threesome with my mind, body, and soul. Leave a brother wholesome. Soul is a place where I toil some. Time setting at my soil run. Drive in the desert in Attica. My heart tilt to the ball in Antarctica. Never thought these moments were necessary till now. Till I sold up and it's in exchange. When seeing on solid ground. So every day I wake up and I pray to each of my moments when I be the same. Then I write up the blessings I have generated by failures and past. Though yeah, back to that moment when I was standing on solid ground. Lucy had my mind up in a chokehold till my voice was found. And said the only reason you left home was to find things you thought you didn't know and find unique ways to let the show. Instead you found ways to cope. Numb to the world, silence the girl, so the girl, he was said, well, there's the only answer to your problems. But my silence told me that you didn't need to go so far from home. You didn't need to go so far.
And now he's got a new EP out.
He has a new EP out called Foreign Land, and it's part of a three-part series he's recording, and he's also working on new singles with Last Gasp Collective, which is also based in Kalamazoo, and he's performed with a lot of different artists over the years, Seth Bernard, The Lasso, Nicholas Baxter, and many others, and I think that's helped him in terms of his work with Last Gasp Collective as well.
And this EP actually netted him some award nominations?
Yes, he is nominated for Jammy Awards on February 8th. That's this Friday in Grand Rapids. And he'll be performing with Last Gasp Collective at the Jammies on February 8th at the Intersection in Grand Rapids as well. He also has a show coming up with Georgia Ray at Final Gravity Brewing in Kalamazoo on March 23.
And now over to a new release from a very familiar Michigan name. You call this release a real coming out party?
Yeah, Max Lockwood, of course, is well known around here for his work with the rock group Big Duty Rue. He's toured the world with May Erlewine as part of her band. He fronts a Tom Petty tribute band that's become very popular over the last year or so, and he's collaborated with a lot of other Michigan artists. But this is his sophomore solo release, and in a lot of ways it's pretty surprising because it's kind of airy. It's more pop-flavored, I think, than a lot of people might expect. It still has that folk rock underpinning and indie rock kind of flavor to it, but I really think it shows his maturation process as a songwriter. It shows a lot of vulnerability and emotionally raw material, and yet very sort of laid back but beautiful at the same time.
This is Tried Love from Max Lockwood.
We cut such a deep breath in the land underfoot until we came on it with all our push. I still can't untangle. Dogs of temperance couldn't make it come undone.
Tried love, 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 tried love.
That is beautiful stuff. And I was unaware of his, really how he got his start. His very first solo effort was actually an academic project.
Yeah, it's pretty funny that his professor at University of Michigan in creative writing and literature, he got a degree there, allowed him to use this album. He mixed in songs as well as poetry for his senior honors thesis for his debut album, and it was great, and it really was a fine album as well. But this really shows, I think, his development as an artist. It'll be interesting to see how he juggles all of his projects as well as supporting his solo efforts.
Certainly a lot of interesting collaborations, as you've pointed out. So he's around, he's soaking up a lot of interesting things from all these collaborators.
Absolutely. And he's actually going to be touring with May Erlewine, who's going to be opening for him on this solo record release tour. He plays February 7th at the Robin Theater in Lansing, February 8th at the Liberty in Benton Harbor, February 9th at Bell's Brewery Eccentric Cafe in Kalamazoo. And then he also has a show February 10th at Salt of the Earth in Fenville, a nice, small, intimate venue. And then he also plays February 23 at Founders Brewing in Grand Rapids with Morgan Hainer and the Transmitters. So there's plenty of opportunities to catch, you know, Max and his new material.
Max is busy, clearly busy with all these projects. Well, you can find out about these and other West Michigan artists, get background information, get performance dates that are coming up. Just go to localspins.com, edited and published by the one and only John Sinkovich. John, thanks so much.
Thanks.
There's a weight on you. And there's a weight on me too.
It is Wednesday. You know that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
And from the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey, the state archivist, and Larry Griffin, a retired research historian, here to tell us about the first minority-owned photography business in the state of Michigan. And Mark, the story actually begins in York, Pennsylvania?
It does. It begins with four brothers led by Glenn Alvin Goodridge. They opened their photography business in 1847, which is really early for photography anywhere. The advent of photography begins with Louis Daguerre in approximately 1839. And so it's quite remarkable that there's a professional studio being set up by these four brothers in York, Pennsylvania in 1847.
So Larry, what kind of work was Glenn Alvin known for?
Well, he was the inspiration and the lead person in terms of the photography business for the brothers. His great area of expertise was, you know, portrait photography. Yes.
But his story, I understand, does not have a happy ending.
No, it doesn't. He was accused of assaulting a female, and he was imprisoned for about 5 years. During the course of his imprisonment, he contracted an illness which would later be his demise.
So he died. Did he die in prison?
No, he was offered clemency. And he, along with the other brothers, would, as part of the clemency, they had to leave Pennsylvania.
Left York, and his two younger brothers, Larry, wound up picking up the photography torch, in a sense?
Yes.
And coming to Michigan? Tell us about that.
Well, what happened was, initially, after leaving York, they moved briefly to Minnesota, and they eventually would settle in East Saginaw. Historians don't know exactly why they came to East Saginaw, Michigan. But we might conject that it might have been because they were familiar with the lumbering, and they knew that Pennsylvania had been one of the tremendous lumbering regions of this country, and Ohio and Michigan were going to be the next in that chain. And so they came into East Saginaw, and they set up a studio in the 1860s, and they would be there to 1922.
When they came in the 1860s, what was it like for them? Were they welcomed into the community, or being African-American, were they kind of on their own?
Well, Saginaw was a bustling, lumbering town community. It was one of the tremendous regions in terms of Michigan's history for lumber production. Saginaw Valley, because of the river system, and also the Muskegon area. Those were two tremendously prosperous areas. And so they built a photography business. And as Mark said earlier, photography was evolving, and they kept up with the times, and they did something that was, to me, very unique at that time, because they were accepted by the majority community. And that is why they're so popular, and that's why they were so successful, because they not only dealt with blacks, but the whites in the community.
And each of the brothers, Wallace and William, had their own kind of specialties. What were those?
They both had their own niches, and Wallace did the majority of the studio work and probably was credited with having the better photographic eye. And William did a lot of the lumber camp shots, and interestingly, that brought them some notoriety later on, even though Wallace was always sort of seen as the more artistic of the two when it came to photography.
What kind of notoriety?
Well, in 1890, the Department of Agriculture selected their work to be put on exhibit as a demonstration of American lumber camps in operation.
And so when you think of the studio work, kind of the portrait work that Wallace was doing, Larry, when you say that they were embraced by the community, so did they have black customers as well as white customers?
They had the cream of the crop from that region, both high society, cultural organizations, civic organizations, clubs, you name it. They photographed everybody.
What are some of your favorite images, you know, Larry, as you kind of look at their body of work? What jumps out at you and why?
You know, Dr. King had a statement. He said that longevity has its place. But I think, to me, the whole body of work that they did, because they had access to the complete community. Everybody came to their studio to have a portrait or something done by the Goodrich brothers.
How important, Mark Harvey, are the Goodrich brothers in giving us a clear sense of what life was like in the Saginaw area in the 19th century and early 20th century?
They're important for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the fact that there is a minority-owned business serving the entire community in the 1870s, 80s, up to 1922. Both black and white customers, completely an accepted part of this community. They were doing studio work. They were doing work in the lumber camps. They had their work displayed at the Centennial Exposition in Paris. And there was just, as far as I'm concerned, there's very few examples like this in the state's history, probably in the region's history. And so we can't underscore the importance of holding this up as an example of something positive. And I'm sure it wasn't all great. That's conjecture on my part. But from what we know, it was unique. The year they opened their studio in East Saginaw in 1863 is the year that Jubal Early rode into York, Pennsylvania, their former home, and ran the Confederate flag up all the flagposts in that town and occupied it.
You think of that moment in history, yeah.
Quite the contrast. Here they are opening this business to serve the community while their former hometown is being occupied by Confederate troops.
What is the Michigan that you see? What did they see through their lens? When you look at their images, Mark, what's the story of Michigan they're telling?
You're seeing a Michigan that many haven't seen yet, especially that far north. It wasn't that many years before. I think it was 1827 that Tocqueville journeyed up to Saginaw. And here they are showing the work in the lumber camps, forests of the area, but at the same time showing the refinement of the community in the studio. So, I mean, at first glance, it might not seem different than other images of that time period, but one of my favorite images is as the brothers posing for a self-portrait in 1879 with a sign that says Happy New Year. And just that communicating that message to people and that sort of frivolity that they had at a time when these are pictures where people don't smile. And they're doing a self-portrait saying Happy New Year with, I believe, a Dalmatian in the picture as well.
And Larry, you say the business lasted until 1922, and why did it end?
The children of Wallace and William chose other ventures to get into. And this was the coming of the movie industry. And so their careers spanned, like Mark said earlier, from almost the beginning of photography up to the silent movies of the 1920s.
That's quite a stretch. And when you think of black entrepreneurs in Michigan and their history, where would you place William and Wallace Goodrich, Larry?
I would say they were the ultimate. Because of the quality of their work, of their workmanship, and their attention to detail, they represent, in my estimation, the epitome of Black entrepreneurship in Michigan in the 19th century.
Mark Harvey and Larry Griffin from the Michigan History Center with the story of the Goodridge brothers, William and Wallace Goodridge, the first minority-owned photography business in Michigan. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have you heard about shoebox lunches? These were a lifeline for African-American travelers during the Jim Crow era, a time when most rest stops and restaurants in the South refused to serve Black customers.
A shoebox lunch is something that women lovingly packed for their travelers back during the Jim Crow era. My mom and my grandmother talk about all of the excitement around the automobile and going on the interstate. But if they got hungry, they couldn't pull over at a rest stop or a restaurant if they were, you know, at the Mason-Dixon line.
On Monday, I spoke with Patrick Coleman, owner of the Southfield soul food restaurant Beans and Cornbread. He's making his own version of the shoebox lunch to commemorate Black History Month. You'll find photos of his boxes and more from our conversation on our Instagram story. Just search for Michigan Radio. Coming up, the fight over Michigan's political maps has gone from the ballot box to the courtroom. After the break, we'll get an update on how each side fared during the first day of trial in federal court in Detroit. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Open source software is something a lot of people understand, where the code for a program or an app is available for free to anyone who wants to make changes. When it comes to a defense against hacking, some engineers believe open source hardware could be a much needed tool against sophisticated attacks. Here to explain how that works is Joshua Pierce. He's professor of materials science and engineering and electrical and computer engineering at Michigan Technological University. Joshua, I think it's safe to say a lot of us don't spend a nanosecond thinking about just what goes into the devices we rely on, from our smartphones to our computers and so much more. So let's start right at the basics. How do you explain open source technology?
So open source just means that the code of whether it's a software or a hardware object is available for everyone to look at. And usually it comes with a license associated with it, which gives people the rights to use it in any way that they want, even sell it. But it has a viral component, which means that if you make a change, then you're obligated to reshare it with the rest of the world. And this method of technological development has been proven to be extremely good at driving innovation forward faster, which is why it's really beginning to dominate in the software field. Anything that you can think of. So supercomputers at this point are 100% running on open source. 90% of the cloud is, more than 80% of the smartphone market, more than half of the embedded systems, and most of IoT. So it's completely integrated into the software world. And what we're seeing now is that same sort of innovation and rapid growth is starting in the hardware world.
And just to clear up any misconception, open source does not mean free, right?
Absolutely. So it means that you're free as in like liberty to use it in any way that you can, but there are companies that make billions of dollars a year literally selling you software that you can download for free. But what they're doing is they're offering a service on top of it and a guarantee. And the same thing on open source hardware. There's lots of open source hardware out there, and you're technically allowed to build it and make it yourself. But in general, people don't do that. They buy the open source hardware, and they take advantage of having that knowledge of how the device or the system was made.
And just for folks who are kind of computer illiterate, break down for us the difference between the software and the hardware.
Software is, we're talking about purely computer code. In hardware, the documentation is similar. So, for example, you might have a CAD package, which is describing a three-dimensional object that is written in code, or it might be written more like a drawing. All the plans, the bill of materials, the electronic schematics, any firmware, hardware, software, all of it is available for free. The materials that go into it, or the knowledge of how to get to them or how to use them, is available for free. And so it's sort of like giving you the source code to design everything from a bed to a computer.
So give us a good example of how this could work, Joshua.
One of the best examples of open source hardware today is 3D printing, where 3D printing has been around since the 1980s, but it tended to be very expensive and only really available at major manufacturers and sort of the top universities. But then a professor in Britain open sourced the first 3D printer, and that rapidly pushed the cost down to well under $1,000. In fact, I built one even for $99, and the technical sophistication and the quality of the printers shot up like a rocket. And so now you can get a very good 3D printer for $1,000 or a couple thousand dollars. You can build one yourself for about $500, and it's all because of driving innovation forward much faster, because it's just not a single company with their group of engineers working on the problem. It's thousands of people all over the world, many of whom are professional engineers working on the problem. And that's sort of the secret that the software community has known for a long time, but now it's definitely infiltrating hardware.
And you've written a piece in The Conversation where you make the case that open source hardware, you believe, could be the line of defense against the next generation of hacking?
Correct. So recently Bloomberg ran an article where they talked about potentially Chinese government infiltrating many of the U.S. military computers and some of the Fortune 500 computers with a hardware hack. And the reason that's so scary is it doesn't matter what software you have on your computer. If someone has direct access to your hardware, your passwords don't mean anything. They can go right in and do whatever they want. However, if the same hardware had been open source, it would have been very easy to root out, because everyone would know exactly what went into the hardware, and then they could look at their own boards and be like, oh, this piece does not belong here. And that is one of the fundamental reasons why open source hardware can be more secure than closed hardware, because the customers actually know what they're getting.
And just how do customers know what we're choosing? How is it we know if we are choosing something based on an open source hardware system? Is it spelled all out there?
Yes. Yeah, so I think every single time someone is selling open source hardware, they actually use it as a selling feature, because they want to encourage community members and their customers to give feedback rapidly so that they can make a better version the next time. Also, the Open Source Hardware Association has a kind of a status tag that you can put on something that says that the hardware that you're purchasing is for sure open source. Now, I want to be clear, just because something's open source doesn't mean that it's inherently more secure. What makes it more secure is that people can look at it and test and make sure that it's more secure. And so maybe the easiest way to think about this is to think about a safe. If you were a secret agent and you had some really important documents that you wanted to keep secure, you could either put it in sort of a proprietary safe where you would have to trust that the company isn't going to let burglars or whatever get access to the details in order to be able to get into it, or you could trust in an open source hardware company making a safe where they're telling everybody exactly how they make it. Now, basic intuition might say, well, then the robbers, the thieves, might also then know how to break the safe. But along with the robbers and the thieves, you also have the entire rest of the engineering world working on making sure that that's safe. And so for me as an engineer, I would feel much more comfortable putting my documents in a safe that I know exactly how it works and it's been vetted by nonprofit groups. And even if I couldn't vet it myself, I could perhaps hire someone to vet it for me to ensure that it was safe and secure. And right now with proprietary hardware, we just don't know whether it's secure. It might be. Hopefully it is. With open source hardware, we have the best possible chance that it is actually secure, because the entire world has their eyes on it.
So you contend this open source hardware would really be a good line of defense against this sophisticated kind of hacking like the one you cite with China and companies like Amazon and Apple, as well as the U.S. military and the CIA. How close are we to being at that point?
We're maybe 15 or 20 years behind the kind of development of open source hardware as compared to open source software. Both fields have been growing exponentially, but to this point, open source software has basically saturated the entire market. Open source hardware is not small anymore, but it's still much smaller than software. But it's moving quickly, and it's moving on every scale. So there's microchip manufacturers, there's electronic boards, there's even open source computers now. So this is all coming and will be available to consumers very shortly if their devices that they're interested in aren't already open source.
Joshua Pierce, professor of materials science and engineering, as well as electrical and computer engineering at Michigan Technological University. And you'll find his piece about open source hardware at theconversation.com. Thank you so much for speaking with us and sharing your thoughts with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me.
Michigan's political maps are on trial in a federal courtroom in Detroit. On Tuesday, a three-judge panel began hearing arguments for and against these maps. Democrats and the League of Women Voters took the maps to court. They claim the 2011 redrawing was an all-out GOP gerrymander, and they're challenging 34 legislative districts. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick is here with us. Sarah, just how did Democrats and the League present this case? How do they support their claim of gerrymandering?
Well, it seems like they're going to go about it in kind of one of two main ways. The first is they're going to look at sort of quantitatively what the gerrymander or what they claim is the represents the gerrymander, which is that they're going to get political scientists who crunch numbers on this type of things and use various kinds of metrics to kind of prove in one way or another, various complicated ways, how gerrymandered the districts or some of the districts are. And one of their first witnesses was a political scientist from George Washington University who did just that. The second way, it seems, primarily is probably won't be that explosive in court, but it's kind of explosive on its own, which is going to be these emails that they've gotten a hold of between various Republican operatives and the Michigan Chamber of Commerce and folks who were on who were responsible for the redistricting in the legislature. And those emails, they purport that they show that this was a very deliberate gerrymander and what they called a sort of secretive, intense effort to actually gerrymander these maps very much in favor of the GOP after they made some pretty big gains in the 2010 elections.
And I think we all remember coverage when those emails were released and there were terms like, you know, keeping all the Dem garbage in one
yes.
area.
Stuffing them into one district or two or three districts, correct,
yeah.
yes.
Now, who are the Republican defendants and what is their argument?
Okay, so the Republican defendants are basically the state Republican legislators, representatives and senators, and also Michigan's congressional delegation, the Republican members of Michigan's congressional delegation, with, I believe, one exception, that being Representative Justin Amash. And basically, they are going about this in a couple ways. The first is that they claim that the Democrats just don't have political geography on their side, which is that, as we referenced before, that email about stuffing, you know, the Democrats into, you know, a handful of districts, maybe in Southeast Michigan and in urban centers throughout the state. Democratic voters do tend to be concentrated in urban areas. So they're saying that Democrats, essentially what one of the lawyers made the argument during opening arguments, have a political geography problem, which is that the maps just naturally don't favor them. And that this is, they're trying to solve essentially their political problems through the courts. Now, the other side would come back and say, well, you know, Democrats have sort of always had this same issue, but we didn't see this big swing in terms of disproportionate number of votes, Republicans getting sort of a much lesser share of votes than their overall dominance in the legislature would imply. But that's the argument that the Republican defendants seem to be making. And then, on the other hand, they're also saying, well, they argue, first of all, that the court lacks jurisdiction even to hear the case because the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't yet or perhaps ever will set a constitutional standard for what actually constitutes gerrymandering. And then there are sort of several other claims, such as that the Democrats made some pretty big gains in the last election here in 2018. So if their proportionality problem is so bad, why did they make these gains? So that sort of seems to be the heart of their argument.
Now, there are several ways the court could rule in this, correct?
Yes, from what I understand, there are. First of all, it could just say, you know, either we can't decide this case right now because the Supreme Court hasn't set any kind of standard, or, you know, we just don't agree that the plaintiffs made their case here and there was any kind of gerrymandering. So that would sort of leave things as they are. They could order maps redrawn for some districts, but maybe not for others. But that sort of raises the question of how do you redraw some legislative districts without affecting the other districts? Or then they could flat out agree with the plaintiffs here and order that all the maps be redrawn. But this is sort of gets to a little point of confusion here, which is that Michigan is actually going to be doing things differently after the next census here. And so redistricting is going to be done by a nonpartisan citizen commission. So, you know, they could just punt on it and wait till then. So there are several ways this could go.
And I know it could be, it certainly is something to watch for people in the Michigan Senate, because they're not supposed to stand for election until 2022, correct?
Correct. And there's a really interesting twist here, which is that one of the original defendants was Secretary of State Ruth Johnson, and she was a Republican. She's since been replaced by Jocelyn Benson, who's a Democrat. And Benson is not actively defending the case. She does have a lawyer representing her there in court, but she's essentially said she agrees that the maps were drawn so blatantly to favor Republicans that it was illegal, and she's not going to actively be defending the case. However, she does agree with the defendants on one point, which is that she doesn't want the state Senate districts to be redrawn before the 2020 election, because essentially that would be, they would have to hold a special election in 2020 for that. And she argues overall that would be just too disruptive to the state elections process. So she does agree with the other defendants on that one sole point.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you, Cindy.
When you learn how to create art, whether it is oil painting or playing in a rock band, you develop more than just a talent. You also learn some pretty important life lessons about things like failure and vulnerability. In our final Creating Connections story, we return to Girls Rock Detroit, where one camper found the confidence to open up and be herself.
Let's get this show on the road. Girls Rock is a camp. Everyone there just learns how to make music, and it's really fun. I'm Maddie. I'm 15 years old. The first year I did it, I was a DJ. DJing has been something that I've been wanting to do for, like, a really long time now. I DJ a lot of different kinds of electronic music. I don't have, like, a definite stage name. The one that I'm going by right now is Z-Trite, you know, Detroit with a Z. I learned that people at Girls Rock Detroit were going to be okay with me messing up. The dress rehearsal, I did a DJ set, and the sound was really messed up. I didn't know what buttons I had hit. I was, like, crying and stuff. But luckily, no one was really upset about that. They were just like, no big deal. It's not like I was performing at Madison Square Garden or something. Second year I went to Girls Rock Detroit, I was interested in finding out what it was like to be in a band. I chose keyboard because I knew how to play the piano a little. I did a lot of the songwriting for my band. The song called Fly. It was about opening up to new things. It's time for you to move out of the nest. This song kind of represents my transition. I actually came out to my mom partly because of Girls Rock Detroit. I just figured if the people at Girls Rock Detroit were going to be accepted of the fact that I'm gay, then my mom might be accepted too. It feels really good to get that off my chest, honestly. There's a big delicious world to discover. And I'm also autistic, so I have a hard time making friends. When I first found out about my autism, I wasn't super open about it. Part of being autistic for me is having, like, awkward body movements. Sometimes I'll jerk my head. At school, people can just be really stupid and mean towards me, which I don't understand whatsoever. But when I started meeting the people at Girls Rock Detroit, I realized that people were going to be okay with it, so... I just spat it out. I'm autistic, and I'm proud of that. I don't think I would be the person that I am today if it wasn't for Girls Rock Detroit. I definitely feel like I have found my community. It feels really good because it lets me know that I'm not alone when it comes to, like, my struggles and stuff.
That was Maddie, a DJ, keyboard player, and songwriter at Girls Rock Detroit. You'll find photos of Maddie and more at our Creating Connections stories on the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Our Creating Connections series was produced by Elizabeth Meister and Dan Collison at Long Haul Productions and funded by the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Katie Raymond, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.